Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, January 5th, 2022. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky defending new guidance for people who test positive for COVID-19 to isolate for 5 days instead of the previous 10 and not need to get a negative test before venturing out. She says it's not because of a test shortage, but that rapid tests do not identify when a person is contagious. White House weighing in on Chicago's public schools closing today after the local teachers union votes to move to remote learning until the COVID-19 Omicron variant surge subsides or until there are additional safety protocols in place. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki saying that President Biden wants schools to remain open for in-person learning and that schools have the tools and resources to do that. A day before the anniversary of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, Attorney General Merrick Garland urging patience from critics who want organizers of the attack or even elected officials charged, promising the Justice Department remains committed to holding all January 6th perpetrators at any level accountable under law, whether they were present that day or were otherwise criminally responsible for the assault on our democracy. Plus, the U.S. Capitol Police Chief Thomas Manger testifying before the Senate Rules Committee on preparations for Thursday. We begin with COVID-19, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidance reducing the recommended time a person should isolate after a positive COVID test from 10 days to 5 days for people who do not show symptoms anymore, and not recommending getting a negative COVID test before emerging from isolation, although wearing a mask for the 5 days is recommended. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky telling the New York Times that the no-test recommendation is based on evidence that shows most people are no longer contagious 5 days after symptoms appear, and the current rapid tests are not reliable for determining when a person is no longer contagious. Dr. Walensky, along with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the chief White House science officer, asked today at the White House COVID response briefing about whether a better test may be coming.
Let's go to Jeannie Bauman at Bloomberg.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my question. I know Dr. Walensky has said part of the reason that CDC is not requiring a test after 5 days of isolation is that's not what the tests are designed to do. So I was just wondering if there are plans by RADx or other programs to develop tests that could actually detect, you know, how infectious you are, how contagious you are. Thank you.
Dr. Walensky, do you want to clarify
So the FDA rapid tests are authorized, as you say, Jeannie, for diagnosis. They are not a quantitative test. They are qualitative tests to diagnose. They're authorized for use in the first 7 days of symptoms. They are authorized for use serially in things like test to stay, where you have a negative and another negative. You can confirm that people continue to be negative. Maybe I'll pass it to Dr. Fauci, to talk about RADx and what is going on in the design of other tests for quantitative purposes.
Yeah. Okay. So obviously there's a lot of work going on in the Bioimaging and Bioengineering Institute of looking at refining and fine tuning tests from every aspect, from sensitivity, specificity, and predictability. And those are ongoing studies now with a considerable investment on a number of investigators. Thank you.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, along with the CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, part of the White House COVID-19 response team, today's briefing. Later in the virtual news conference, another question to Dr. Walensky about the testing recommendation, why it's different for healthcare workers, and any role, perhaps, of a testing shortage.
Let's go to Catherine Yvonne at Vanity Fair.
Thank you very much for taking my question. On December 23rd, the CDC issued a guideline saying that healthcare workers with COVID-19 could return to work after 7 days with a negative test. About 4 days after that, the CDC issued a guidance not requiring a negative test after 5 days for people to return to work. Can Dr. Walensky just explain the distinction between those two guidances and whether the omission of a testing requirement to emerge from isolation was driven by the shortage of available tests?
Maybe I'll take that in two parts. First of all, this has nothing to do with the shortage of available tests, because you can see in our quarantine guidance that we actually do recommend a test for people to emerge from quarantine, and we do anticipate that there will be more people in quarantine than there are in isolation. But to your question about healthcare workers, our infection control and prevention guidance for healthcare workers is historically and always much more conservative than it is for the general public, and that is by design. That is because our healthcare workers are routinely caring for people who are immunosuppressed, routinely caring for vulnerable populations. So it's absolutely the case that all of our healthcare worker guidance with regard to COVID-19 and all other transmissible diseases are much more restrictive and much more conservative with regard to return to the workplace for our healthcare workers. And that's the reason for the discrepancy.
CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky. Dr. Anthony Fauci also saying today that preliminary data suggests the Omicron variant does not cause more severe illness than earlier variants of COVID-19. But he said a certain proportion of the large volume of cases, no matter what, are going to be severe. So don't take this as a signal that we can pull back from recommendations about the need for vaccinations, for boosters, for wearing masks. More on COVID-19 rapid tests. Reports across the country, they are hard to find on store shelves. John Porcari, the port envoy to the White House Supply Chain Disruptions Task Force, asked today whether any supply chain problems that emerged as the COVID-19-inspired economic shutdown began to ramp back up have played a role.
The Virginia Department of Health said on Tuesday that it's experiencing supply chain issues with getting COVID-19 tests, rapid tests. Can you speak to what's being done to address that issue, not just in Virginia, but all across the country? And do you anticipate it being a problem in terms of getting the 500 million tests that the president wants to bring online?
Well, first, I think what that illustrates is that it's the global supply chain, and it's a global COVID issue that's affecting all countries. We have a procedure in place to prioritize medical supplies as needed. If you'll see in today's White House blog that there's an example of within the last week of medical supplies being prioritized by the ocean carrier, by the longshoremen, the railroads, the terminal operators, to move those supplies. We're working closely with the COVID task force as they designate those priorities. We have a procedure in place, starting with the place of manufacture of those medical supplies, to identify them early as they're put in containers, make sure those containers are separately identified, are what we call block stowed in a position on a ship where they can be the first off, and then are prioritized for unloading. That would have to happen, obviously, on a priority basis.
But do you anticipate that the distribution of the 500 billion tests that the president is looking to bring online could be slowed down?
We're working hard to make sure that those tests are there when they're needed. And together, this supply chain, with the millions of people that work on it, have met the challenges so far. We expect to continue to do that.
John Porcari is the port envoy to the Biden administration Supply Chain Disruptions Task Force, briefing reporters in the White House briefing room. Jeff Zients, White House COVID-19 response coordinator, adding that the 500 million at-home COVID-19 tests the administration plans to send to Americans for free later this month will not diminish the number of tests available on pharmacy shelves. As COVID cases are again rising sharply across the United States, the issue of whether to keep public schools open again being debated. This from the Chicago Tribune. Chicago teachers' union leaders say they are scheduled to meet with Chicago Public Schools on Wednesday after the union endorsed a plan to refuse to work in person until extra COVID-19 safety measures are in place. District officials canceling Wednesday's classes in response. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki asked today if the federal government will get involved.
I wanted to start with Chicago. Can you tell us if the White House or the Education Department or the administration at large is doing anything to help get teachers and students back into school there?
Well, we are in across government. We are in regular contact with a range of stakeholders on the issue of school reopening and closures, including superintendents, state leaders, principals, teachers, parents, and other school staff. And that is certainly the case now, today, this week, as the president is working and we are all working to keep schools open. As the president said yesterday, he wants schools to be open. We know they can be open safely, and we're here to help make that happen. And he agrees with medical, scientific, and education experts that because of the historic work we've done, we are more than equipped to ensure schools are open. And we're going to keep our children and educators who selflessly serve their community safe, but ensure that children are not enduring the mental health impact of not being in school, that there are not gaps in learning. This includes schools everywhere, including in Chicago. Fortunately, 96% of schools are doing just that. And just as a reminder, and I know I touched on this yesterday, but the president and our administration foresaw early on that schools across the country would need additional resources. That's why he fought for $130 billion in the American Rescue Plan for funding to schools to implement mitigation strategies, including $10 billion in for testing, which has already been distributed to states. And the Department of Education has also been providing technical assistance and resources for months now on everything from implementing mitigation strategies to connecting schools with testing providers, hosting vaccine clinics, and addressing pandemic related mental health issues. So long story short, we want schools to be open. The president wants them to be open, and we're going to continue to use every resource and work to ensure that's the case.
The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki in the White House briefing room with reporters. 73% of Chicago Teachers Union teachers voting to work remotely until January 18th, unless there's a safety agreement in place. Jesse Sharkey is president of the union, and he held a virtual news conference today.
Last night, the membership of the Chicago Teachers Union voted overwhelmingly to begin a remote-only work action in our schools today in response to a surging coronavirus epidemic. We're almost 2 years into this pandemic, and this is the third significant wave that we've seen. In each of the first two waves, in-person school was paused. Teachers and other school staff delivered instruction and services remotely. What we're currently seeing with the Omicron surge is record high case numbers, but not just record high case numbers. Also, we're seeing hospitalizations that are near their peak for the entire two-year pandemic. And we're seeing that this is a vaccine-evasive variant. I understand that there are a lot of political leaders in the city, the mayor in particular, who was extremely angry at the idea that people inside the schools would take action for ourselves. But what the mayor doesn't understand is that through the course of this entire pandemic, the city has failed to deliver a whole number of basic demands that we need in the schools, has failed to provide adequate staffing, adequate cleaning in the schools, has failed to provide adequate testing, has failed to address our concerns as people go into the schools. There was even a moment where the public health commissioner, Dr. Allison Arwadi, told us, why should the schools be open when the schools be closed when the bars are open? I mean, the public health commissioner got to ask herself that question. We don't think bars should be open, and we think that, but we're not the ones that get to control bars. The mayor and the public health commissioner are the people who got to control that. The thing that we can control is the basic understanding of the situation, which is that right now, going into schools puts us at risk, puts our students and families at risk of contracting the coronavirus. That's the simple truth of the matter.
Jesse Sharkey is the president of the Chicago Teachers Union, part of a virtual news conference today. Chicago has the third largest school district in the country, about 350,000 students. The Teachers Union using the hashtag Lori Lockout, referring to the mayor, Lori Lightfoot, tweeting today that it's been inundated with calls and emails this morning from educators who say they've been unable to log on to their CPS accounts to teach remotely. On Wall Street today, the Dow down 392, NASDAQ down 522, S&P down 92. From CNN, England will scrap the need for double-vaccinated travelers to present a negative pre-departure COVID PCR test upon arrival starting at 4 a.m. local time on Friday, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced today. He said, "We will be scrapping the pre-departure test, which discourages many from traveling for fear of being trapped overseas and incurring significant extra expenses." Today was also the first Prime Minister's question time of the new year. Opposition leader Keir Starmer, though, was not there. He has tested positive for COVID-19. In his place, the Deputy Labour leader, Angela Rayner, who began talking about the economy and a topic which has also been a concern in the United States, inflation.
Mr. Speaker, inflation is about to hit 6%. That's the highest rate since the early 90s, when the Conservatives have been in power for over a decade, marred in their sleaze with a divided party, a Prime Minister losing the support of his backbenchers and governing shambolically, and a Labour Party, Mr. Speaker, who is ready to take over and provide the Britain with a better future. Promised wage rises would offset inflation. They haven't and they won't. Millions of British workers now face a further pay cut, and his Chancellor is handing them a tax hike. What will the Prime Minister do to get a grip of this?
Mr. Speaker, I know that she it's great to be here with the Right Honourable Lady, the Shadow Secretary of State, for the future of work. We know the future of the job that she has in mind. But I wish her well. But what we are focused on, Mr. Speaker, is delivering jobs for the British people. And it is a quite extraordinary thing that there are now record numbers of people in work, Mr. Speaker. 420,000 more than there were before the pandemic began, Mr. Speaker. We have youth unemployment at a record low, Mr. Speaker. And never let it be forgotten that when Omicron hit this country, Mr. Speaker, what was their instinctive response? They said, yep, that's right, Mr. Speaker. They said they needed a roadmap, that we needed a roadmap to lockdown. If we listened to them, we wouldn't have anybody working at all, Mr. Speaker.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, leader of the Conservative Party, questioned by the Deputy Labour leader Angela Rayner, main opposition party. Prime Minister's question time in the British House of Commons in London, the first of 2022. The British newspaper The Independent writing that Boris Johnson has wrongly denied saying there was no need to worry about soaring inflation, despite saying fears were unfounded just 3 months ago. Next to Russia and Ukraine, this from the Associated Press, the U.S. and Germany said Wednesday that Russia's military buildup near Ukraine's border poses an immediate and urgent challenge to European security, and that any intervention will draw severe consequences. But the country's top diplomats left open what those consequences would be and how differences on arming Ukraine and a controversial Russian gas pipeline will be resolved. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock sought to present a united front on Russia after a meeting in Washington. They held a joint news conference. Here's a question to the Secretary, Antony Blinken.
The first U.S. question goes to Missy Ryan of the Washington Post. Missy, if you could unmute yourself and ask your question, please.
Thanks, Nin. First question is for Secretary Blinken on the Russia-Ukraine situation. Mr. Secretary, the Russian government has emphasized that a deal must be struck quickly, but at best, next week's negotiations seem likely to result in an agreement on future talks or some sort of broad framework. Are you concerned these discussions will not move fast enough to head off a Russian invasion? And in addition, given that Russia appears to want to deal primarily with the United States on a range of issues affecting NATO, and the U.S. wants to limit bilateral talks to bilateral matters, what are your expectations for any sort of breakthrough?
Missy, thanks very much, and good to see you virtually, and Happy New Year. A couple of things. First, we have been very clear, the United States and Europe together. We have laid out two paths for President Putin and for Russia, the path of diplomacy and de-escalation, and the path of deterrence, including the serious costs, the massive consequences that Russia would incur if it renews its aggression against Ukraine. And we are now in the process, the starting process, of testing whether this path of diplomacy and de-escalation can bear fruit. And that depends very much on whether Russia is truly willing to engage it. We have, coming up next week, conversations with Russia bilaterally between the United States and Russia through something that was established last year, the Strategic Stability Dialogue. This came out of the extension of the New START agreement to look at ways that Russia and the United States could continue to pursue arms control. But we're going to have a special session of that dialogue to deal with some of the issues of concern that Russia's raised, as well as issues of concern that the United States has. But at the same time, we are pursuing a conversation with Russia through the NATO-Russia Council, as well as at the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, that the United States, Russia, all of our European partners, Ukraine, and others are part of. And this gets at the fundamental point that President Biden has made absolutely clear to President Putin. When it comes to questions of European security, there is going to be nothing about Europe without Europe. Not just full coordination, full consultation, but participation as well. And that is the basis upon which we're proceeding and will continue to proceed. There are some issues that rightfully fit within the Strategic Stability Dialogue between the United States and Russia because they go to arms control between our countries. But many of the other issues that Russia has raised and that we, the United States and Europe, will raise, rightly fit in the province of NATO and Russia, or for more broadly, the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. I believe that if Russia is serious about pursuing diplomacy and de-escalation, that there are things that that all of us can do relatively quickly to build greater confidence and to reduce some of the concerns that we have. There are also issues that could be on the table that would take some time to work through, particularly, for example, when it comes to arms control. You don't come up with an arms control agreement in a matter of weeks. So the real question is whether Russia is serious about diplomacy, serious about de-escalation. It's important that we begin these conversations. I think if they're going to bear fruit, if they're going to show real progress, that will require de-escalation. It's very hard to make actual progress in any of these areas in an atmosphere of escalation and threat with a gun pointed to Ukraine's head. So let's see where this goes over the next weeks. Again, I think we are together, as well as with our allies and partners in Europe, absolutely committed to pursuing diplomacy and de-escalation, just as we are committed to standing up for the principles that are at risk and for Ukraine's sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken, a joint news conference in Washington with the visiting foreign minister of Germany. Blinken also warning that a Russian invasion of Ukraine could mean a shutdown of the controversial Nord Stream 2 pipeline between Russia and Germany. He said the pipeline does not have gas flowing through it at present, and if Russia renews its aggression toward Ukraine, it certainly would be difficult to see gas flowing through it in the future. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you get your podcasts. An article from USA Today: Attorney General Merrick Garland on Wednesday pledged to pursue the perpetrators of the January 6th assault at any level, saying federal authorities would follow the facts wherever they lead. Garland's remarks come as the attorney general faces mounting pressure from lawmakers and others to take a more aggressive action in the January 6th inquiry, including some who have urged that former President Donald Trump be held accountable for inciting the attack. That was from USA Today. Here's part of what the Attorney General said today in Washington.
In complex cases, initial charges are often less severe than later charged offenses. This is purposeful, as investigators methodically collect and sift through more evidence. By now, though, we have charged over 325 defendants with felonies, many for assaulting officers and many for corruptly obstructing or attempting to obstruct an official proceeding. 20 defendants charged with felonies have already pled guilty. Approximately 40 defendants have been charged with conspiracy to obstruct a congressional proceeding and/or to obstruct law enforcement. In the months ahead, 17 defendants are already scheduled to go to trial for their role in felony conspiracies. A necessary consequence of the prosecutorial approach of charging less serious offenses first is that courts impose shorter sentences before they impose longer ones. In recent weeks, however, as judges have sentenced the first defendants convicted of assaults and related violent conduct against officers, we have seen significant sentences that reflect the seriousness of those offenses, both in terms of the injuries they caused and the serious risk they posed to our democratic institutions. The actions we have taken thus far will not be our last. The Justice Department remains committed to holding all January 6 perpetrators at any level accountable under law, whether they were present that day or were otherwise criminally responsible for the assault on our democracy. We will follow the facts wherever they lead. Because January 6 was an unprecedented attack on the seat of our democracy, we understand that there is broad public interest in our investigation. We understand that there are questions about how long the investigation will take and about what exactly we are doing. Our answer is, and will continue to be, the same answer we would give to, with respect to any ongoing investigation. As long as it takes, and whatever it takes, for justice to be done, consistent with the facts and the law. I understand that this may not be the answer some are looking for, but we will and we must speak through our work. Anything else jeopardizes the viability of our investigations and the civil liberties of our citizens.
Attorney General Merrick Garland. Joining us now with more on this on the phone is Devlin Barrett, Washington Post national security reporter. Thanks for being with us. The Attorney General said that some are not satisfied with how long the investigations are taking and who is being prosecuted, who isn't. What is he talking about?
Well, there's been a growing criticism, mostly from the left, of folks who want to see more prosecutorial activity against political actors, people like the activists and Trump advisors who had prominent organizing roles in the rally that became a riot. And, you know, he's been hearing some of that from the left. There are other parts of the country who really are still very upset about what happened January 6th. It's not exclusively from the left, but it's primarily from there. And a lot of the speech, I think, was designed to sort of ask for patience as the Justice Department continues to investigate.
What type of charges could be leveled against the activists or elected officials?
Well, you know, one of the early charges that was tossed out there as a possibility is something called seditious conspiracy, which is a very rarely used charge that carries a lot of potential prison time. But to be honest, it's a rarely used charge because the law itself is both broadly written and very narrowly applied in practice. And I think there's a fair bit of hesitation on the part of prosecutors to take that step, at least so far, based on what they currently know, especially because there's other charges like obstruction, assault, that carry some significant jail time anyway, that are not nearly as legally or factually complicated.
A few hundred people have already pled guilty. Others have been charged. The Attorney General is saying today it's normal that early cases will have less severe charges than later ones. So could we be seeing some bigger cases coming down?
Oh, definitely. And I think a lot of what the Attorney General tried to do today is almost give sort of a teacher speech. It's almost criminal justice 101, what he described in a lot of that speech, because it's the low-level folks, the lesser offenders in all sorts of criminal cases who often plead out early to the lightest sentences. That's pretty standard for an investigation. The other thing he's trying to emphasize to people is, look, this is the biggest criminal investigation we've ever had in terms of defendants. This is going to take a long time. And I think, you know, frankly, in the internet age, you know, there's a lack of patience sometimes with how the federal court system works.
We're talking with Devlin Barrett from The Washington Post. Can you give us a sense of how big this is? I saw somewhere that there's still a few hundred suspects who committed some violent acts that day that have not been identified.
Oh, absolutely. So they've charged more than 700 people. That's the most criminal defendants ever in a federal in a single federal case. There are, if you add in the number of unidentified suspects who they're still seeking to arrest, you get north of 1,000. And if you add in a number of all the people who went into Congress that day as part of the mob, they estimate you're really north of 2,000 people. So it's a vast enterprise. It's an incredibly daunting task ahead for the prosecutors. And there's going to be a lot of gradations of conduct and guilt and punishment. And I think part of the AG's message today is there's going to be a lot of variation here. You're just going to have to be calm and patient with us.
On another subject, you wrote another story today that said that senior Biden administration officials concluding that the government's January 6th preparations were hampered by a lack of high-level information sharing, a failure to anticipate how bad the day could be. What did you find?
So it's really interesting. There's a lot of internal review still going on in the government to decide what went wrong leading up to January 6th. We've obviously done a lot of reporting about red flags that were missed and preparations that weren't made. But, you know, the Biden administration can't really wait around another half a year or longer for those findings. So they've made some of their own decisions. And they've decided that there weren't enough high-level officials sharing important intelligence beforehand. And they failed to really, you know, contemplate how bad it could be. And that cost them dearly on January 6th. And so they're taking steps now to try to make sure, to try to fix what they see as those misjudgments and hopefully prevent the next kind of attack from happening.
Devlin Barrett, Washington Post national security reporter. Find his stories at WashingtonPost.com. Thank you.
Thank you.
A new poll shows that more than half of Americans think an attack like the January 6th assault will happen again in the next few years. 58% telling that to Axios Momentum. By party breakdown, 70% of Democrats think it'll happen, 52% of Republicans. We're learning more about what President Joe Biden will say Thursday morning at the U.S. Capitol on the anniversary of the January 6th attack. He and Vice President Kamala Harris scheduled to speak. It'll be at 9 a.m. Eastern. C-SPAN will carry it live. Today, a question to the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Tomorrow, the president is going to speak on Capitol Hill. Is he going to address his predecessor's role in the riot?
Yes. And let me give you a little more preview of that. So, in addition, and I know I noted this yesterday, but I think it's important for people, so let me briefly reiterate. The president is going to speak to the truth of what happened, not the lies that some have spread since, and the peril it posed to the rule of law and our system of democratic governance. He will also speak to the work we still need to do to secure and strengthen our democracy and our institutions, to reject the hatred and lies we saw on January 6th, and to unite our country. I'd also note that President Biden has been clear-eyed about the threat the former president represents to our democracy and how the former president constantly works to undermine basic American values and rule of law. And President Biden has, of course, spoken repeatedly about how the former president abused his office, undermined the Constitution, and ignored his oath to the American people in an effort to amass more power for himself and his allies. He sees January 6th is a tragic culmination of what those 4 years under President Trump did to our country. And they reflected the importance to the president of winning what he has called many times, and you've heard him call many times, the battle for the soul of our nation. So just as you heard him say on January 6th of last year, I would expect that President Biden will lay out the significance of what happened at the Capitol and the singular responsibility President Trump has for the chaos and carnage that we saw. And he will forcibly push back on the lies spread by the the former president in an attempt to mislead the American people and his own supporters, as well as distract from his role and what happened. So he will, of course, speak to the moment, to the importance in history of the peaceful transfer of power, of what we need to do to protect our own democracy and be forward-looking, but he will also reflect on the role his predecessor had.
Will he call Donald Trump out by name?
We'll see. We're finalizing the speech, but I think people will know who he's referring to.
The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki with reporters. We learned Tuesday night that former President Trump canceling his scheduled news conference for Thursday at his home in Mar-a-Lago, Florida. In a statement, the former president blaming the House committee investigating the January 6th attack and what he calls the fake news media, and again falsely claiming that there was massive fraud in his loss to President Biden in the 2020 election, calling it the crime of the century. But CNN writes, a person familiar with the situation told CNN that Trump decided to call off the event due to the news media's apparent lack of interest in covering it live on Thursday. Former president was also facing pressure from outside advisors and Republican lawmakers to cancel the news conference and instead keep a low profile on Thursday. That was from CNN. Today, Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana asked about all of this.
Obviously, tomorrow is the anniversary of January 6th. What do you make of that day? Are you going to be here? Are you going to mark the day in any way?
I'll be going to Johnny Isaacson's funeral. That's number one. Number two, clearly, it was a stain upon our nation's history. And we've got to figure out what went wrong and make sure it doesn't go wrong again.
What do you make of President Trump canceling his speech tomorrow? Do you think that was the right move?
Well, his advisors told him not to, so they apparently thought it was the right thing to do. So I can't speak beyond that.
And what do you make of Democrats trying to link the anniversary of January 6th to pass a rules change to get voting rights legislation? Do you think that diminishes the importance of the anniversary?
They've been looking for a reason to pass the federalization of election laws for a long time. I'll just point out that Georgia, who they're complaining about, has more liberal election laws than Delaware, President Biden's home state in a deeply blue state. And so until you can point out to me, after record turnout in 2020, and Georgia being more permissive than Delaware, what the problem you're trying to fix is, I think they have a bill they're trying to pass and looking for an excuse to pass it.
That's Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican from Louisiana, with reporters on Capitol Hill. He mentioned going to Johnny Isaacson's funeral. That's a former U.S. senator, and the Senate minority leader, Republican Mitch McConnell, leading a delegation to Georgia for that funeral tomorrow. But two House Republicans do plan to hold a news conference to talk about the January 6th attack anniversary. Matt Gaetz of Florida, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia. And we'll have coverage of that on Thursday. The House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol meeting tonight with Stephanie Grisham, former White House press secretary to Donald Trump. NBC News reports the meeting came about after Grisham and Congressman Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland, a member of the panel, spoke by phone about her knowledge of what happened inside the White House on the day of the riot. Grisham has distanced herself, writes NBC News, from Trump's orbit since January 6th, the day after she resigned from the White House in response to the riot. The U.S. Capitol Police Chief Thomas Manger testifying today before the Senate Rules and Administration Committee. Manger taking over as chief over the summer and has been implementing some recommended reforms of his force. Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat from Minnesota, chair of the committee, asking him today about Thursday, the anniversary, and the plans.
We all remember, as I noted in the opening, the haunting words of the officer, "Does anyone have a plan?" As you note, in recent months, the department has made clear progress with respect to operational planning. In your testimony, you called this a game changer, the fact that you have this department-wide incident assessment plan. Can you briefly expand on what has been done to improve preparedness for large events? I know you noted you hired someone who has key experience with that. Anything else you want to add?
So we have an incident action plan prepared for tomorrow for the anniversary of January 6th. This is a copy of it. It's 25 pages long. In it, everybody's responsibilities are laid out. This information is shared with everyone so that a captain who's in charge of one division knows exactly what's going on in the other divisions as well as his or her own. So we are sharing information better. We are assigning responsibilities. People know what their responsibilities are. And we have backups to each one of the different commanders. So the blueprint that has been created we've used it many times since the 6th, and we're very confident that it gives us everything we need to ensure that the planning that we do, the sharing of information, and that everybody on the department understands what their responsibilities are.
As I noted, Senator Blunt, in my legislation, which was importantly co-sponsored by many members of this committee, gave you and, in general, the Capitol Police Chief authority to request assistance from the National Guard in an emergency. It was cloudy at best before and very difficult procedure. How will this improve your ability to respond in potential future emergencies at the Capitol?
Well, clearly, it cuts through the red tape and allows the Capitol Police Chief to make that call directly. I have spoke with the Department of Defense, and in fact, am meeting with them later today, and to make sure that we have the process down, so that if the time ever came that we needed to make that call, everyone would know what the expectations are on both sides of the call. So. That is very helpful. But I will just say this, that my hope is that with the other processes, planning that we've put into place, that there's not going to be the need for a panicked call for in an emergency, that those things will be planned ahead of time so that we'll have better coordination
exactly.
In advance.
U.S. Capitol Police Chief Thomas Manger, questioned by Senator Amy Klobuchar, chair of the Rules and Administration Committee. As she noted, the ranking Republican on the committee is Roy Blunt of Missouri. In his opening statement, Blunt saying the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol was a tragic day for our country. Everyone who took part in that attack should be prosecuted based on their actions and plans. That process continues, and I support it. When it came to questioning the chief, one of the issues he brought up was an idea that the Capitol Police had floated, bringing in private security.
Chief, on the issue of bringing in contract employees, Officer Papathanasio has suggested that the union rep, that this would be a problem for them. Do you want to talk about how you're going to deal with that? Obviously, in my view, a bigger problem for them is the overwork and the extended stress of being short so many officers. But tell me how you plan to work with the officers who are concerned about bringing in non-sworn officers to do even parts of this work.
So I've been in discussions with the union about this specific issue. They have mentioned a number of concerns, and our conversations and our intent is to try and address those concerns because I think what we agree on is that these officers need some relief, that we need to allow these officers to get more time off, to stop being held over on their shifts, to stop being forced to work overtime when they would rather be home with their families. So, I've talked about the strategies that we have in place, but the contract security would be a temporary solution until we can get more officers hired. And my intent is to try and address the concerns that the union has with regard to where these contract security officers are assigned.
And for that program to really work, what kind of temporary program would it be? Would you anticipate a multi-year bid or a one-year bid with possible extensions? Or what are you thinking about as you begin to think about how you look for these contract employees?
So realistically, I think it's going to take us at least 2 to 3 years to get up to our staffing in terms of hiring new officers. So having that as an option to use over the next 2 or 3 years, I would like to have that option.
Just to be sure we're straight on this, hiring the officers to get to the officers you currently are allowed to have is the problem here, as opposed to the Congress saying we're going to give you 100 more officers than you're currently capped at. That's an unrealistic moment for us to think about. Your goal is to fill the slots that you already have been allowed to have, and you're 400 short. Are you 400 short right now of,
yes,
of meeting that number?
Yeah, actually 457 short.
457?
Yes, sir.
Capitol Police Chief Thomas Manger with Senator Roy Blunt before today's Rules and Administration Committee hearing. Politico, reporting on the private security proposal, writes that a job posting was published on Sunday, calls for applicants to apply to Intercon Security Systems Incorporated for the, quote, exciting role of an unarmed security officer for the Capitol Police. And it listed responsibilities include many of the tasks assigned to current armed Capitol officers, and that the pay starts at $24 an hour with an additional $4.23 an hour for health and welfare. That compares to about $31 an hour for a private in the Capitol Police Force. Finally, this from NBC News. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards granted a posthumous pardon Wednesday for Homer Plessy, whose refusal in 1892 to leave a whites-only rail car led the Supreme Court to uphold state racial segregation laws in what is considered to be one of the most shameful decisions. Edwards, a Democrat, signed the pardon during a ceremony outside the former train station in New Orleans, where Plessy boarded a train bound for Covington, Louisiana, before his arrest 130 years ago.
While this pardon has been a long time coming, we can all acknowledge this is a day that should have never had to happen. 130 years ago, Homer Plessy bought a ticket, boarded a train right here where we sit, bound for Covington, just 40 miles to the north. And I know you know the rest of the story, and I'm not going to recite it for you. The subsequent Supreme Court case, as Professor Bell so powerfully described, led to generations of inequity. It left a stain on the fabric of our country and on this state and on this city. And quite frankly, those consequences are still felt today. Homer Plessy more than did his part to prevent that stain, and so did many others. And we honor them all today, and their names have been mentioned. I want to highlight today the one eloquent and courageous dissent from Justice John Marshall Harlan, who, I think it should be noted, belonged to a family that had enslaved people of color. He initially, though he was a unionist, he was not in favor of emancipation. But his views of race, equality, civil rights, they did change. And his dissent cogently and powerfully made the case that Plessy versus Ferguson was incorrectly decided. That dissent accurately predicted the damage that it would do to our country, and it inspired Brown versus Board of Education some six decades later. Further, Justice Harlan's dissent demonstrates that justice and decency dictate the absolute necessity that we come together this morning for this posthumous pardon, so that the last chapter in this saga exonerates Homer Plessy and celebrates his cause as right and just.
Governor John Bel Edwards outside the train station in New Orleans. The Louisiana Board of Pardons unanimously voted back in November to clear Plessy's record. Descendants of Homer Plessy and John Howard Ferguson, the Louisiana judge who initially upheld the state segregation law, were both there. They have forged a friendship, and they both advocated, both sides advocated for the posthumous pardon. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Today, and for more top Washington stories, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word. Just go to c-span.org/connect to sign up. Hope you have a good night.